Very good morning. Thank you for joining us here at the UN office at Geneva for this press briefing today, the 4th of October. We have another very packed agenda. We have a few announcements. We'll start off with our colleague Pascal from the Human Rights Council. We'll obviously then we'll go on to Sophie Fisher of ILO. We also have briefers who will address the situation in Lebanon as well as in Gaza, as well as an update from the FAO. So again, very packed agenda. We'll start off immediately with Pascal for an announcement and then over to Sophie from ILO. Pascal.
Thank you, Rolando. Good morning, everyone. The Human Rights Council is beginning today the consideration of the last item of its agenda, which is dedicated to technical assistance and capacity building. A total of 10 countries will be considered until this agenda item at this 57th session. At around 11:15 today, the Council is holding an enhanced interactive dialogue on the nuclear legacy in the Marshall Islands. Deputy High Commissioner Nada Al-Nashif and the Special Rapporteur on Toxics and Human Rights, Marcos Orellana, will participate in this dialogue. And we also expect the participation of members of the National Nuclear Commission of the Marshall Islands. This afternoon at around 3:30 p.m., the Council will hear an oral update from the OHCHR on the situation in South Sudan. And on Monday morning, the Council will hear reports from Vitit Muntarbon, the Special Rapporteur on Cambodia, to be followed by Isha Difan, the Independent Expert on Somalia. On Monday afternoon, we will hear a report from Yao Akbetse, the Independent Expert on the Central African Republic, and a report from the UN Human Rights Office on Penitentiary Systems, Security and Justice in Honduras. And on Tuesday morning, until I speak to you for the next briefing, the Council will hold an enhanced interactive dialogue on the Democratic Republic of the Congo. High Commissioner Volker Turk will participate in this dialogue along with the team of international experts on the country. And you will also have the participation of the head of MONUSCO, Bintou Keita, the chief of the peace operation in the DRC. We received all the draft text for consideration for adoption for this end for this 57th session. We have a total of 38 draft texts, one presidential statement, and 37 draft resolutions. Four of these draft resolutions are new initiatives, one on the elimination of domestic violence, a second one on the social reintegration of persons released from prisons, a third one to mark the 30th anniversary of the Beijing Declaration and Platform of Action on Women's Rights, and a fourth one on biodiversity and human rights. About one third of these draft resolutions concern country situations, and several of these draft resolutions request the renewal of mandates for investigations and experts. The fact-finding mission for the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, 2 years. The fact-finding mission for the Sudan, 1 year. The team of international experts on the Democratic Republic of the Congo, 1 year. The special rapporteur on the Russian Federation, 1 year. The special rapporteur on Afghanistan, 1 year. Special rapporteur on Burundi, 1 year. Independent experts on Somalia, 1 year. Independent experts on the Central African Republic, 1 year. And the special rapporteur on climate change, 1 year. I'll be able to share with you the list of these 38 draft texts, hopefully this afternoon, as well as the running order for their consideration that will begin on Wednesday afternoon. Thank you.
Thanks very much for that comprehensive brief. Pascal, do we have? I do see a question for you from Christiane of DPA. Christiane.
Thank you, Rolando Pascal. Same question as always. Do you know whether there's anything special happening on the 7th at the Human Rights Council to commemorate the events 1 year ago? Thank you.
Thank you, Christian. Listen, so far, the Secretariat of the Presidency have not received any request or proposal to commemorate this anniversary on October 7th, but I will strongly advise that you stay alert on what's going on in the room, starting at 10 a.m.
Thanks very much, Pascal. Indeed, we'll be focused on the proceedings as you approach the last week of the Council. Any further questions? I don't. Oh, there it is. Body, please.
Hi, Pascal. A petite question sur le rapport complet des droits de l'homme sur la situation du Soudan. Il paraît le rapport sera soumis par la mission en demandante, mais il n'y a pas encore sorti, ou bien il faut attendre encore le moment. Merci.
Est-ce que vous parlez du rapport de la mission d'établissement des faits? Écoutez, le rapport a été présenté au début de cette session, le mardi, si je me souviens bien. Par contre, il y aura un rapport additionnel qu'on appelle Conference Room Papers, qui devrait être publié incessamment sous peu, on espère peut-être lundi. Mais je vous tiendrai au courant, vous en aurez les détails, ce lundi.
Okay, I don't see further questions, so thank you very much, Pascal, and good luck once again. Okay, we'll now throw to our colleague from the ILO, Sophie Fisher, who has an announcement on a publication concerning Gaza, and then afterwards we'll go into some of the briefings on Gaza and then Lebanon. But over to you, Sophie.
Thanks very much. Good morning, everybody. As you said, just a quick announcement. On Monday, the ILO is going to be releasing the fifth and latest in its series of bulletins on the unemployment and livelihood situation in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. This one is entitled A Year of War in Gaza, Impact on Employment and Livelihoods in the West Bank. The report, we are hoping to put it out at 11 a.m. Geneva time, which is midday in Beirut. The report is being prepared by our Beirut office. Unfortunately, there will be a media advisory later today. Unfortunately, we won't be able to give you advance copies because the report isn't actually ready yet. As you will appreciate, this is going down to the last minute to complete it. The report will cover the period from the start of October 23 to the end of September 24, and it compares the situation in that period with the preceding 12 months. The primary point of release of this report is Beirut, but as you can imagine, the press there has a lot of other things, so we are also releasing it in Geneva. It will be distributed to you. Hopefully interviews will also be available if anybody wants one.
Thank you very much. Very well noted. Sophie, questions? Yes, Christiane has a question for you.
Yes, hello, Sophie. It will be available Monday morning, though, not at 11 only, right?
Yes, 11 only. And please, if that slips a little bit, bear with us. That will be because of the fairly obvious logistical reasons and related to getting the relevant clearances from people who are in Beirut who have quite a lot on their plates at the moment.
Yeah, indeed they do. Thanks very much for that, Sophie. And of course, do connect. We have a question from Imogen, BBC.
Yeah, just to clarify, have you got an embargo on it or how does this work? It's we can report on it as soon as you finalize it and give it to us?
Yes, no embargo.
Okay.
Okay, got that. Question for you from John Zarakostas.
On the number of people that have fallen below the poverty line in Lebanon, and if your Beirut office has some new estimates of Lebanese nationals and also refugees, the levels of poverty in Lebanon. Thanks.
Sorry, I missed the bit at the beginning of your question because I think you were off mic, but I think you were asking about levels of poverty among Lebanese and refugees.
Lebanese nationals and also migrants and refugees in Lebanon, if you have new estimates from the ILO or your Beirut office, and how many are below the poverty line, basically.
Yeah, okay. I will need to ask them because that's not directly the subject of the upcoming report.
No, it's not. It's a separate because I know you track this stuff very much. And since you're doing a joint study with World Bank, I think they do this tracking as well. So I was interested if you have something similar on Lebanon.
I'll ask and come back.
Thanks very much to you both. And good luck with that publication, Sophie. Okay, we're going to stay on the subject of Gaza now. Colleagues, we're turning to, I think Margaret has two guests. Margaret Harris of the World Health Organization would like to introduce two guests who join us from Jerusalem. And yes, I believe they're both speaking from Jerusalem. So, Margaret, over to you.
Thanks very much. And I'll be very quick because it's a packed agenda. Yes, we have Dr. Michelle Tirin, who's our special representative for Israel. And we also have Dr. Ayadil Saperbikov, who's our emergencies lead in the occupied Palestinian territories. And I think we will start. It looks like Michelle is already ready, so we'll start with Michelle.
Michelle, over to you.
Thank you. I'm speaking from Tel Aviv, Israel. October 7 is on Monday, and in Israel, and for all Israelis, October 7 is their 9/11, and the last year has been a lead determinant of ill health in Israel and a continued engagement for WHO in Israel to respond to it. For Israel, Monday is 1 year after October 7 massacre, and it is the largest on its soil. October 7, 24 marks 1 year of captivity of 101 hostages who from their timeless tunnels may not realize that yesterday it was their New Year's celebration. October 7 in 2 days will mean in Israel being away from home for 75,000 people for who their hometown from Shelomi, where I was a few days ago, and to Kiryat Shmona is the incubator of another October 7. For the 10 million Israeli and residents here, it has been a year which saw over 19,000 rockets fired towards the country indiscriminately. WHO has so far verified 68 attacks on healthcare in Israel with 24 dead. For all of the above, this Monday will mark 1 year of a collective trauma that has spared no one in the country and has spread at pandemic speed and has doubled and in some part tripled the demand for mental health care. As we speak, the entire health system of the north of Israel, including the third largest city, Haifa, operates underground in reconfigured shelters and parkings. This represents very complex working and living conditions for thousands of patients and health workers. A patient without daylight is a patient without natural strength to heal. There is an immense resilience and impressive readiness on the health system here, but at a great human cost for patients and healthcare workers. For WHO in Israel, October 7 represents 1 year of solidary presence with the health authorities and with the people of Israel. It is 1 year of bearing witness of the constant existential fear for 10 million people living in the country and its impact on health and health behaviors. It's 1 year of support to the family of hostages and the family of the displaced populations. For WHO in Israel, October 7, 24, will mark 1 year of emergency mental health interventions for the most vulnerable and for the first responders. This is a pact made between the Israeli Ministry of Health and the WHO Regional Director for the European region, Dr. Hans Kluge, to leave no one behind. It is 1 year spent on dozens of site visits, areas of massacres, forensic institutes, ghost evacuated city, evacuation and displaced centers, hospitals, bedside of victims, border areas and commemoration events for the many lives lost and more. Finally, October 7 for WHO in Israel means 1 year of reporting on Israel and Israeli realities and 1 year of continued humanitarian bridging and dialogue for anyone affected outside Israel. No one heals without peace, and in Israel, no one heals without the return of 101 hostages left in Hamas hands. This was in all the New Year wishes, which I could hear yesterday during Rosh Hashanah celebration. Dr. Tedros, WHO Director General, was very clear yesterday. The unspeakable suffering in Israel and throughout the region must stop. Peace is the only and good medicine.
Thank you very much, Michelle. We'll now hear from Dr. Saperbikov.
Thank you so much, and good morning. It's been 12 months, and the hostilities in Gaza continue to range. Over 6% of population of the entire Gaza Strip has been killed or injured, and an estimated 10,000 people remain trapped under the rubble. The health system of Gaza Strip has suffered immensely from the repeated attacks and from the ongoing shortage of supplies, medicine, fuel, and staff. Since October 2023, WHO recorded at least 516 attacks on healthcare in Gaza, which resulted in 765 deaths. Only half of the Gaza hospitals are partially operational, and only 43% of the primary healthcare facilities in Gaza Strip are functioning. The working hospitals that still remain open provide the bed capacity of only 1,800 beds, which is supplemented by around 650 beds in 10 operational field hospitals by emergency medical teams. This falls far short of the need in the strip. Many of the hospitals that are still functioning have been reduced to a fraction of their former capacity. They lack specialized staff, they lack supplies, they lack equipment to treat complex injuries and the complex diseases that are currently exist in Gaza. According to the Ministry of Health, around 1,000 health workers have been killed. This is an irreplaceable loss and a massive blow to the entire health system of Gaza. Al-Shifa, which was once Gaza's largest hospital, has not yet returned to its former state, despite all the best efforts by WHO and partners at the siege that has left it in ruins. I still remember when I visited, the stench of a rotting blood and death in the courtyard of the Al-Shifa hospital. I recall the panic and the fear on the people's faces when they rushed themselves and their loved ones into the overflowing hospitals, where patients were spread across the floors, corridors of emergency rooms, and in every possible space that they could occupy inside the hospital. I witnessed patients crying in pain due to the lack of pain management. I also met a surgeon in As-Sakhabah Hospital who shared with me a story how he himself amputated his knee's leg in his own kitchen table with his own kitchen knife, because there was no safe access to the hospital. Gazans have been living through hell and continues to suffer. The situation is still grim. Many essential health services are still not available. Gaza's only limb reconstruction center in Nasser Hospital is no longer functioning. And the sole psychiatric hospital remains out of hospital. Oncology, imaging services are unavailable. Specialized pediatric surgery is not available. Endocrinology services are not available. Vascular surgery has been compromised, among many other critical services. We estimate that around 24,000 people in Gaza are suffering from life-changing injuries due to the conflict, and they have no access to rehabilitation or specialized care. We recently met a man who had crafted his own prosthetic leg using a broken crutch and some wood. While this speaks to the resilience of Gaza people, no one should have been doing this. We are deeply concerned about the impact of the conflict on mental health and psychosocial status of people in Gaza. Prior to the conflict, there were almost 500,000 people who have already been diagnosed with mental health disorders. Malnutrition is another concern. Since January this year, more than 20,000 people, children, have been admitted for the treatment of malnutrition, including more than 4,500 children with severe acute malnutrition. Over 96% of women and children aged 6 to 24 months are not meeting their nutritional needs due to lack of diet diversity. Pregnant women and new mothers are enduring unbearable conditions, unable to access hospital due to the constant displacement. I've met many mothers who have shared their stories of living with their newborns in the hospital stairwells, because there is no privacy, there is no room for them to stay. They have been forced out of the hospital for the second day after their delivery due to the different safety issues that they face. Winter approaches and communicable disease remain a significant public health threat. Acute watery diarrhea and acute respiratory infections account for more than 80% of all cases of reported cases of communicable disease in Gaza during the first 8 months of 2024. The poor water sanitation and hygiene conditions, alongside with overcrowding in shelters and lack of primary health care services, are the primary drivers of this disease. These conditions, we expect, will worsen during the winter, likely leading to a further rise in cases of morbidity as well as mortality. As the burden of health services continues to grow, the medical evacuation out of Gaza remains severely limited. As of 30th of September, out of more than 15,000 cases requested for medical evacuation, only 32% have been approved by the Israeli authorities. This is around 5,130 patients. Since the closure of Rafah crossing in May 2024, only 219 patients have been evacuated out of the Gaza Strip. We as WHO urgently call for the establishment of multiple medical evacuation corridors to ensure safe, organized, and timely passage of patients via all available routes. Despite the extreme challenges on the ground, WHO remains in Gaza, doing everything possible. Out of 214 missions that we planned within the Gaza Strip since October 2023, only 44% have been facilitated. And through those missions, we delivered fuel, medicine, supply that helped restore hospitals. We also deployed emergency medical teams to support the Gaza's health system. Together with our partners, we have been able to vaccinate 560,000 children in the first round of the polio campaign last month. Repeated evacuation orders and ongoing hostilities continue to disrupt humanitarian operations. We call for effective deconfliction and protection of the healthcare. We call on safe access to health facilities and to sustained aid flow into and across Gaza. In closing, I wanted to commend the resilience of Gaza's health workers. They are heroes who, without rest, continue to care for other people, often at great personal cost to their own mental and physical health. They are fulfilling their oath of medicine and humanity beyond measure. It's been 1 year, 365 days of bloodshed, pain, and suffering. Ceasefire now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ayadil and Michelle as well. Do we have questions for our colleagues from WHO? Okay, we'll start in the room first row. Robin of Agence France-Presse.
Thank you. It's a question for Michelle. In the north of Israel, how many patients are being treated in those reconfigured underground shelters that you talked about? And in southern Israel, a year on, can you give us an overview of the healthcare situation in those areas that were affected by the October 7 attacks? Thank you.
When I say the entire inpatient system in Israel, North Israel, is operating underground, it counts by thousands, including the health workers at their bedside. What I saw 4 days ago is an entire parking lot with about 500 to 700 hospital beds, and we should count certainly two or three healthcare and associate workers for each bed. So that was a lot of people. There were two floors like this under Rambam hospitals in Haifa. Same things in the central hospital of Haifa called Zion Hospital. Same thing in Aharia. Same thing in Safed, and I visit them all. And then still Ashkelon Hospital around Gaza is still in that situation. So you really can count by a few thousands of patients and healthcare workers working underground.
Thank you very much, Michelle. I think Margaret must have, if not already, she will soon send the notes. So I think there are some questions about the notes, the details that were shared. Musa Al-Mayadeen.
Thank you. I have a question about Gaza. Do you have any information about the use of uranium bombs in Gaza during the last year? Thank you.
Thank you for your question. WHO does not have any information about, and this is not part of our mandate. Over.
Okay, fair enough. We have a question for you from Emma of Reuters.
Hi, good morning. A question for Dr. Serbikov, please. Has the Polio 2 campaign now been approved? Has Israel given its go-ahead? And do you have any details of that? And for Dr. Tiran, please, what is the perceived risk of polio actually in Israel? I understand a significant portion of the Orthodox population is unvaccinated. So how do you see that risk? Thank you.
Who wants to start? Maybe the first question for Michelle?
Yes, the risk of Israel is cannot be discarded, and the initial immunization coverage in Israel are not homogeneous. It's very high, but in certain population segment, and especially after the COVID, there has been some indent in the coverage. That's why we really need to be very careful here. The risk is taken seriously. We cannot say that they will be, but we know that the exchanges between Israel and Gaza will only but increase, and therefore we need to be careful. This is how it entered in Gaza from elsewhere as well. So the chain of that strain going needs to be stopped at some point.
Thank you. And I believe
thank you for your question.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry, doctor, go ahead.
Thank you for the question. There are ongoing discussions with the Israeli authorities, the COGAT and the Ministry of Health of Israel, as well as the partners on the ground on the second round of the polio campaign. We have requested the start of the second round of the polio campaign on the 14th of October. So this is a week from now. 10 days from now, and we expect that the vaccination should finish by the 29th of October. We have communicated those days to the Israeli authorities, and we're having a meeting on coming Sunday to see whether this will be confirmed. But we are very hopeful that learning the lessons from the previous successful polio campaign will continue to support the children 0 to 10 years in Gaza with the polio supplementary immunization activities. Over.
Thank you very much for that clarification. We have a question from Nick Cumming Bruce of the New York Times.
Thank you. Yes, just following up on the polio issue, Dr. Idle, could you just update us on the numbers of children who have been affected by this, or adults? Well, thank you.
Thank you very much. For the second round of the polio campaign, we estimate that around 590,000 children should be vaccinated with novel oral polio vaccine 2, and these are the children aged 0 to 10 years. In addition to the polio vaccinations, they also will receive a dose of vitamin A. This is an oral vitamin to boost the immunity. Over.
Okay, thank you for that elaboration. We have a number of hands going up. Maybe back to Nick, because you have a follow-up, I trust.
Just a quick follow-up on the number of children who have been affected by polio virus since the first case was announced. Thank you.
Number of children affected by the polio virus?
Thank you. Thank you very much for the question. So far, through the epidemiological surveillance of acute flaccid paralysis, the laboratory has detected only one child, 10 months old child in Gaza, who has circulated vaccine-derived poliovirus 2. There are additional samples that have been collected and sent to the lab last week, and we expect the results of that investigation to be available within the next 2 weeks. Over.
Thank you very much. A question from John Zarakostas of the Lancet.
Hi. Yeah, my question is to Michelle. I was wondering, sir, if you could bring us up to date on the number of civilians that have been injured since October 7 on the cross-border exchanges. And if you could repeat the number of health personnel, I think that you mentioned, killed, and how many were injured. Thanks.
The number of of injured altogether is 7,600 around, and the number of health attack is 68 with 24 dead. Those are the numbers that we are reporting.
I was interested in the northern injury levels. You're mentioning the north and the south. In the northern exchanges between Hezbollah and the Israelis in the north.
No, I don't have a disaggregated number to offer you at this stage, but I will look around and you will receive that.
Thanks, Michel. Yeah, maybe Margaret, I know there's a lot of numbers being thrown around, very important that we get clarity on those, so thank you in advance. We have a few questions online. Lisa of Voice of America, over to you.
Thank you, Orlando. Good morning. And to both gentlemen, I'd like to ask you, given the political stalemate in the region, could you give your impressions or what you think, how the Palestinian population in Gaza views the situation, whether they've given up hope in terms of any sort of a ceasefire and their outlook for a future, indeed, if they have a future, if they think they even have a future. And regarding the Israeli population, I guess a similar question, but also I would like to know whether you think that the families of hostages, how are they feeling? I mean, do they believe that perhaps the hostages will be killed? The Prime Minister Netanyahu seems determined to continue this war and not agree on the relief of the release of the hostages, which was a kind of primary demand or belief by the Israelis that should be done. Thank you.
Do either of you want to comment on these questions? I can also just maybe remind you, as we have been repeatedly from this podium here, and of course, the Secretary General has been calling for an immediate ceasefire since the beginning, immediate and unconditional release of hostages, obviously the effective delivery of humanitarian aid, including much-needed medical supplies, which the doctors are speaking to. But perhaps our colleagues from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem have something to add.
From Tel Aviv, perhaps. My impression is, it's what I observed every day, there is much more peace and hope, and hope for peace among the people here in Israel that one could believe. There are wishes that the hostages will return safely, and this is central to all the humanitarian debate here in Israel, even the political one. I think the commitment is certain, and the families are with that that hope and that relentless claim and certainty that something positive will happen.
Thank you very much, Michel. Okay, a couple of hands still up. We still want to, we're going to address the situation in Lebanon shortly afterwards, but Emma and then Jan Dirk Herbermann. So Emma of Reuters again.
Thank you. It was just to clarify, the second phase of the polio campaign, you envisage as well for there to be pauses in the fighting, and you're asking Israel to agree to that. If you could just clarify that, that is your request. Thank you.
Thank you for the question. That's correct. As I said, the discussions with the Israeli authorities, including the COGAT, the Ministry of Defense and the Ministry of Health, are ongoing. We have asked the Israeli authorities to consider the similar scheme that we had for the first round, with something they call tactical pauses during the working hours of the campaign, during the days that we have been indicating. There seems to be a commitment to this tactical pauses, and we are hopeful that all the parties of the conflict will continue to adhere to those pauses when they are announced. And we will be hearing from the Israeli authorities shortly. Over.
Thank you. Thank you very much. One additional question from Jan Dirk Herbermann.
Yes, good morning. I also have a question on numbers. According to the Gaza Health Authorities, more than 41,000 people have been killed in the Strip. And at the same time, the UN is reporting that around 10,000 people are feared to be buried under the rubble. Now, I was wondering, are these 10,000 included in the 41,000, or are the 10,000 additional casualties of the war? Thank you.
Thank you. So far, the Ministry of Health has reported that 41,689 people have been killed. The estimated 10,000 people who are buried under the rubble is a separate figure from the number of killed. Over.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Ayadil. I think that exhausts the questions on Gaza. That said, we'll shift north to the situation in Lebanon, and we have three briefers who are going to brief you. One from UNHCR, that's Rula Amin, who is a senior communications advisor for the UN Refugee Agency, who joins us from Amman. We have Matthew Luciano, who is IOM's head of office in Lebanon, who joins us from Beirut. And introducing here is Christian Cardone, who's the new chief spokesperson of the ICRC, who's also going to address the situation in Lebanon, as well as in the Middle East generally. So we'll start off with Rula. Over to you. You're muted, or something is with the we don't hear you. There you go. Sorry, before I start, I was a bit discourteous of me. I just really normally thank our speakers joining us from WHO, and I neglected to do that, but I just really wanted to thank Ayadil and Michelle, and of course Margaret, for having our speakers from WHO address these very important points. So thank you very much, and apologies for not saying that earlier. Back to you, Rula. Over to you.
Good morning. So I'm going to brief on the displacement situation in Lebanon and the influx of people fleeing to Syria. So as you may expect, the intensifying Israeli airstrikes and orders to evacuate for people in southern Lebanon are forcing more families in the country out of their homes, desperately looking for a safe spot. Now, with the areas targeted being expanded, the areas people had deemed safe earlier on are no longer so. So many people are having to flee and move over and over again. To date, most of the displacement in Lebanon is internal and within the country. The government estimates up to 1 million people have fled to places across Lebanon, and more than 185,000 people had actually chosen to cross the border to Syria, mainly through the Masnad Jdeidet Yabus border crossing. The Israeli airstrikes overnight targeting the road in the no man's land at the Masna border crossing has put a halt on traffic, effectively closing off this route for vehicles at this crossing. And this is the main entry point for tens of thousands of people and has been the main entry point for those people in the past week. There are still three other border crossings that are open and operational, but this is the main one. And today, vehicles cannot use it. Now, with more people displaced every day, most of the nearly 900 government-established collective shelters in Lebanon have no more capacity to host all those displaced. On the streets of Beirut and even at the most famous landmarks like the Corniche, hundreds of stranded men, women, and children are sleeping in the open. UNHCR is working with humanitarian partners and Lebanese authorities to urgently meet the needs of those displaced and to try to find safe shelter for those who are still without any shelter. UNHCR's response continues to focus on all affected communities, Lebanese and refugees. And since October 2023, UNHCR has distributed more than 223,000 relief items for individuals in need and 70,000 individuals have received multi-purpose cash assistance. UNHCR continues to repair or support collective shelters and has expanded its hospital network to 42 hospitals across Lebanon, allowing for broader coverage of much-needed emergency medical care. Now, as the humanitarian situation continues to deteriorate, UNHCR is working to reinforce its supplies of much-needed core relief items to meet the increasing needs and to prepare for any possible further escalations and displacement. However, the volatile security situation and ongoing Israeli airstrikes are disrupting and delaying relief supplies, such as an airlift carrying medical trauma kits that enable hospitals to perform life-saving surgery. A shipment from Amman with over 20,000 thermal blankets was also delayed. It crossed into Lebanon, but there were significant delays. Now, at the Syrian-Lebanese border, the influx of people fleeing to Syria continues. The Syrian authorities have kept the border open for people to enter from Lebanon. And UNHCR is at the four main Syrian official border crossing points alongside the Syrian Arab Red Crescent and other UN humanitarian partners and NGOs. Of course, this is to support those who cross into Syria, mainly from Jaidat Yabus in rural Damascus, which remains the primary entry point. The arrivals so far are mainly Syrians and Lebanese. There are also Palestinian refugees, Iraqis, migrants, and other nationalities who are crossing into Syria. UNHCR supports the new arrivals with water, food items, blankets, legal assistance on issues such as documentation. Many people fled their homes without any papers. They have been away from Syria for years. Many, they don't have birth certificate, other documents, so we're helping on that front as well. Rub holes had also been provided, and UNHCR protection teams are also at these border crossings to support. Now, some 60% of the new arrivals are children and adolescents. Some of the children have arrived on their own without family members. And as they flee the bombings, families arrive with profound physical and emotional fatigue and huge needs for support. Some require urgent medical care after the long journey. The majority of the new arrivals head to their original towns and villages to join relatives elsewhere. And some of them do need accommodation. As such, hosting centers across the country in rural Damascus, Tartus, Latakia, Homs, and Hama are now accommodating both Syrians and Lebanese who fled. UNHCR is also supporting these centers with core relief items, as well with supporting repairs at these centers to make them more dignified to receive those displaced by the conflict. UNHCR and SAARC are also continuing to support authorities in transporting thousands of the most vulnerable from the borders to their final destinations. There are now UNHCR-supported regular buses, and they take these people mostly to Damascus, Ar-Raqqa, Aleppo, Homs, Latakia, and Hama. But the suffering of those who cross does not end at the border, unfortunately. After 13 years of crisis, many are going to destroyed homes, damaged infrastructure, and crippled basic services. They have arrived with no resources to help them provide for their families' most basic needs. We have to remember, inside Syria, until this day, there are more than 7.2 million people who are still internally displaced inside the country and are in need of humanitarian assistance. Now, UNHCR is not stopping at the border, so we're following up with those who had just arrived in their final destinations. And UNHCR is expanding its existing humanitarian programs in Syria through more than 110 community centers around the country. So we can support those who have newly arrived along with the other vulnerable populations in the country, but more resources are desperately needed. With the onset of winter, UNHCR is concerned that conditions for those affected by the escalating conflict in Lebanon will only worsen. We have already started dispatching essential winter assistance for recently arrived families. We have to also remember that some of those who flee are now fleeing Lebanon to Iraq. According to the Ministry of Interior in Iraq, over 5,000 people have arrived since the 24th of September. They either fled onward from Syria through Al-Qa'im crossing or had arrived by plane to Baghdad or Najaf. UNHCR's humanitarian response is severely underfunded, both in Lebanon and in Syria. More resources are needed. The interagency flash appeal for Lebanon was launched on October 1st in Beirut. It aims to mobilize more than $425 million to deliver life-saving assistance to 1 million people. UNHCR's portion of this appeal is estimated at $111 million. In Syria as well, UNHCR operations is only about 27% funded, and we, along with UN partners and NGOs, are trying to mobilize more resources to meet the huge additional needs. There will be a flash appeal for Syria early next week, and it will be led by UNHCR. The international community must step up the support to all those displaced as a result of this conflict. Every day this conflict continues means more lives lost, more people displaced, and more hardship. UNHCR reiterates the Secretary General's call for urgent de-escalation and calls on all parties to ensure humanitarian workers have safe access to civilians in need of support. An urgent political solution to end hostilities must be the priority. Happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Rula. Thank you very much. Oh, what we'll do, colleagues, as I mentioned, we'll take the three briefers on Lebanon, and then we'll take questions at the end. And I now turn to Matthew Luciano. And I thank you, Matthew. I know that you may need to run quickly. He is IOM's head of office in Lebanon, joining us from Beirut. But thank you very much for joining us. Matthew, over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me to brief. So indeed, I'm the head of office of IOM here in Beirut, where, as you know, the situation is really deteriorating rapidly. I wanted to speak to internal displacement as well, and to the hundreds of thousands of people who've been forced to flee their homes in the past 2 weeks in particular. You've all seen the images on TV, the roads jammed with traffic, the people sleeping in public parks, on the street, on the beach, as UNHCR said, along Beirut's Corniche as well. So as of 2nd of October, IOM has identified over 500,000 internally displaced persons, with 400,000 displaced in just the last 2 weeks. Of these, more than 165,000 are living in 800 collective shelters across the country. These are schools that the government has urgently opened. Of course, the numbers continue to rise as heavy shelling continues in the south, in the Bekaa, in Beirut, and other regions in the country. In addition to internal displacement, and as UNHCR said, tens of thousands of Lebanese, but also Syrians, are leaving the country both through legal and irregular means. Between 23rd of September and October 3rd, 235,000 individuals crossed into Syria by land. 82,000 Lebanese and 152,000 Syrians, and these are the figures from the Lebanese authorities from yesterday night. During the same period, so 23rd of September to 3rd of October, 50,000 people departing from Beirut airport, mostly Lebanese, but also 10,000 Syrians, and 1,060 people fled by sea. However, I mean, as Rula mentioned as well, at 5 a.m. this morning, Israelis airstrikes against the Lebanese border crossing in Masna, which is the that closed the main road, international road connecting Lebanon and Syria, and that's the road that hundreds of thousands of people have used in the past 10 days to flee the bombings, and that's now been cut off. The conflict intensifying, so IOM has launched a flash appeal as well to raise $32 million, which will assist 400,000 people affected by the crisis over the next 3 months, and this is part as well, as UNHCR said, of the appeal that was launched by the UN on Tuesday. Since October, IOM has scaled up our immediate life-saving assistance, providing essential relief items like blankets, mattresses, kitchen sets, solar lamps, as well as protection services and health support to the ADPs. And we're also helping partners by tracking internal displacements These are the figures that I mentioned. You can find them online. We're now publishing two reports every week on Monday nights and Thursday nights with updates on internal displacements. And those are actually published and released in coordination with the government, with the Prime Minister's office. So our team, emergency response team, they're delivering aid across Beirut, Mount Lebanon, the north, the Bekaa, the south, and at the Syrian border as well, where, as I said, 235,000 people have fled due to the violence. I'm pleased to report that we have successfully relocated many of our national staff, and all IOM staff members are safe, even if they continue to assist those affected despite the significant constraints and challenges in the country. I want to take a moment to highlight the plight of Lebanon's 180,000 migrant workers, many of whom are female domestic workers. They come from Ethiopia, from Kenya, from Sri Lanka, Sudan, Bangladesh, the Philippines, and they too have been deeply affected by the violence in the country. We are receiving increasing reports of migrant domestic workers being abandoned by their Lebanese employers, either left on the streets or in the homes as the employers flee. Many have been forced to leave, but they face very limited shelter options. Yesterday, I visited a shelter in Beirut, which is run by GRS, which is currently housing 64 Sudanese families who had nowhere else to go. We have received, as IOM, increasing requests for migrants who seek assistance to return home. And in the last 24 hours as well, many IOM member states have requested IOM's help to evacuate their citizens from Lebanon. This will require significant funding, which we currently do not have. I want to stress the importance of an inclusive response, and UNHCR will agree with me on this. Everyone in need, displaced Lebanese, migrants, refugees, and any other vulnerable populations must receive the support they need. The massive crisis demands immediate actions. The needs are significant, and we call on the international community to provide the resources needed to ensure the safety, dignity of the displaced families and anybody affected by the crisis. Our appeal is part, as I said, of a larger coordinated effort with UN agencies and other humanitarian organizations to scale up response efforts in Lebanon. 32 million that we're appealing for will sustain IOM's life-saving operations for the end of the year, and we're prepared to expand our efforts as needed. Thank you very much.
Thanks to you, Mathieu. And lastly, Christian Cardone, who's ICRC's new spokesperson, chief spokesperson. And maybe you can introduce yourself briefly, then maybe go off into your brief. And then, of course, we'll share his contacts.
Okay, good morning, everyone. Yes, indeed, Christian Cardon just started as the chief spokesperson. Prior to that, was working in the field of protection and spent several missions in the Middle East, Gaza, Lebanon in particular. I wanted to start by just very briefly taking stock of what we have seen over the last hours, the last days, what has been described in details by some of the colleagues before. And obviously starting with Lebanon and the so fast intensification of hostilities over the last days. Just before coming here, we were exchanging with our spokesperson on the ground. And before starting our usual, you know, update of what we do, where we work, what we can do, what we cannot do, she was basically sharing her personal experience of last night, where her kids just woke up screaming, being totally shaken. And that's happening not in the south of Lebanon. That's not happening in the southern suburbs of Beirut, but that's happening in central Beirut. And that was last night, and I'm sure that the colleagues based in Beirut who speak before can just confirm that. And that's not happening in Gaza. That's the reality in Lebanon, Beirut, over the last days. Yesterday, West Bank affected, people killed in Tulkarem after bombing, which did not happen for years. Tuesday evening, sounds like it was, you know, months ago, Tuesday evening, the population of Tel Aviv and many others outside of Tel Aviv in Israel went through a panic and distress again. And then, as we've said repeatedly in this briefing, in a few days we will be commemorating what is happening, what is still happening in the Gaza Strip. Yesterday, again, was talking to colleagues in Gaza, this trying to explain me the situation, trying to put words, and we've all tried to put words on the situation there. But I think the good summary was, Christian, we're not living anymore in Gaza. We're just trying to survive. And everybody is affected. Everybody is affected. And that was not the case in previous escalation, everybody being affected in Gaza. So killings, injury, displacement, panic, distress continues while we speak and just continue also to spread. And this is why ICRC today, and you will see our statement after this briefing, we just can only again urge and call the parties, obviously, while we speak about the Northern Front, Hezbollah, and the Israeli authorities, to make sure they protect civilians. What does this mean? Is that civilians should be spared from attacks. Civilians should be able to leave their home, flee, and go to more security, if they can find security. Respecting the rules of war also means that hospitals must be protected, must be spared from attacks. Ambulances, we've repeated that again and again over the last years, obviously. But this is, unfortunately, once again, the situation that we are facing, and now in another place. This also means that the use of explosive weapons in populated areas should stop because of their dramatic effect on the civilian population. So once again, the ICRC urge, as I said before, and call for a respect of the basic rules of humanitarian law, protecting civilians. We are convinced, and as we've seen in many other regions, many other places, in conflicts of different nature, that respecting these basic rules is definitely could facilitate the road to de-escalation. Respecting the basic rules of international humanitarian law can facilitate the road to de-escalation. So more than ever, today in the region, in the Middle East region, those fighting, I mentioned Hezbollah, I mentioned the Israeli authorities, but of course Hamas and many others, should respect these basic rules. It's the moment, and it's also the moment for those having an influence on them to respect. I just wanted to end on what we are trying to do in very difficult conditions, again, in Lebanon, very much focused today on the health response. We've been working, of course, for months in preparing health facilities, health workers, to a massive influx of injured people. This is already happening after only a few days, unfortunately. But that's where we put the energy. While I speak also, a plane is on its way, a cargo plane is on its way to Beirut with lots of medical assistance again. And that's just the start of a response that we are stepping up. But that cannot be unlimited. I've heard colleagues before referring to appeals. Let's be very clear that if the situation continues to spread, we will all be facing major challenges in the way we respond and how we can respond. Thank you very much.
Thank you and welcome once again. Merci beaucoup. Okay, we'll start with questions in the room. We have two, then we'll turn online. And if you could specify to whom you're pointing your question. Moussa Al-Mayadin.
Merci beaucoup. J'ai plusieurs questions pour ICRC. La première, je voudrais savoir, donc durant les 48 heures, on a entendu au Liban que le phosphore blanc a été utilisé en bombardant Beyrouth
et la banlieue du sud de Beyrouth. Si vous avez des informations là-dessus, parce qu'on a, donc, on a eu un contact ce matin avec les nurses libanaises avec la CANU et ils ont mentionné ce développement dans la guerre. La deuxième chose, si vous avez un nombre de morts et des blessés côté israélien par les bombardements de Hezbollah, donc en nord d'Israël, et en même temps, si vous avez le nombre de tués et blessés au Liban depuis le récent développement. Merci.
À la première question sur l'usage du phosphore blanc, on n'a pas d'informations à confirmer à ce stade. Ce que je peux vous dire, c'est que notre dialogue, j'aurais dû le mentionner avant, continue, aussi bien avec les autorités israéliennes que le Hezbollah, à différents niveaux, autorités civiles, mais aussi autorités militaires. C'est la manière dont fonctionne le CICR. Donc, c'est évidemment quelque chose qu'on va regarder de très près. Je tiens aussi à préciser que l'accès des humanitaires à certaines zones est rendu extrêmement compliqué par rapport à l'intensification des combats. Et donc, évidemment, que c'est quelque chose qui sera prioritaire sur notre liste, mais à ce stade, on peut clairement pas confirmer cette information. Je ne vais pas m'aventurer sur le nombre de blessés et de morts depuis le début de ce conflit. On parle de plus de 1000 morts. On a entendu 1 million de déplacés. Je pense que d'autres ici sont peut-être mieux à même de donner de la précision, mais au moment où je vous parle, ça continue aussi bien au Liban qu'à Gaza. Et donc, je ne voudrais pas vous communiquer de chiffres, de faux chiffres qui continuent d'évoluer.
Merci. Pardon, et côté israélien, vous avez des chiffres approximatifs au nord, je ne parle pas de Gaza.
Non, par rapport aux récentes, je veux dire, depuis que le front s'est ouvert au nord, non, je n'ai pas de chiffres précis par rapport à ça.
Merci beaucoup. Okay, we'll take a question from John Zarakostas of The Lancet and France 24.
Yes, good morning. I was wondering, sir, if you could bring us up to speed on the number of hospitals and medical centers that the IC is supporting with material support. You mentioned a plane is flying in. If you could give us details on the supplies that it's carrying. And if you also have ICRC emergency teams on the ground doing trauma interventions, if that could be, and if any of the facilities that you support have been attacked. The WHO mentioned yesterday that 28 health personnel were killed in just one day. Thanks.
Thank you very much. So indeed, we are supporting health facilities, as you mentioned, across the country. But obviously, these days, with a clear focus on the south of Lebanon and also Beirut, in particular, the Rafik Hariri hospitals, but tens of medical structures in the whole country. When it comes to the cargo plane, at the moment, and the good news, probably the only positive news, is that all actors are still present on the ground. The stocks are still there. So this is more about medical materials rather than medicines that will be sent, because obviously we are preparing for the wars and we know that this won't necessarily last in terms of the capacity of the medical sector to cope with the current situation. When it comes to attack on our facilities, at this stage, the facilities that we are supporting have been spared from attacks.
Thank you, Christian. Okay, we'll go online. We have a few questions. Jérôme Lanche of Radio France Internationale, and if you can direct your question to whom is best.
Thank you, Rolando. I've got two questions. Maybe I will ask the first one in French, as it is for IOM and Mathieu. Je voudrais savoir à quoi ressemble aujourd'hui la vous avez parlé à plusieurs reprises de la corniche de Beyrouth. À quoi est-ce qu'elle ressemble aujourd'hui? Est-ce que vous arrivez à quantifier le nombre de personnes qui sont sur la corniche, qui dorment sur la corniche? Est-ce que voilà, il y a des tentes sur plusieurs kilomètres le long, voilà. Et est-ce qu'il y a une présence des humanitaires, du HCR, de IOM là-bas? The second question will be in English, maybe more for UNHCR. You talked about Ms. Amin talked about the refugees, the returnees, sorry, in Syria. We know that they fled. To like the Syrian returnees, they fled to Lebanon for a reason, because of the civil war. And some of them might be subjected to detention or torture when they got back to Syria. So I was wondering, are you concerned about the fate of those returnees in Syria? For they don't have anything waiting for them in Syria, but they also might be arrested. So yeah, can you comment on that?
Merci, thank you, Jeremy. I think Mathieu, are you still connected? I know he had to leave.
Pour la première oui, question. Non, je suis encore là, merci.
D'accord.
Peut-être avant de répondre à la question de Jérémy, juste une question précédente, si vous me permettez, sur le bilan en matière de morts et de blessés au Liban. Le ministre de la Santé a donné une conférence de presse hier soir. Donc les chiffres sont disponibles dans les médias. Depuis octobre, c'est 1974 décès, y compris 100 médecins enfants et 97 personnel médical et 9384 blessés. Donc ça, ce sont les chiffres du ministère de la Santé hier soir pour le Liban. Concernant la question de Jérémy de RFI sur la corniche, alors que ce soit le long de la mer sur la corniche, ou bien dans les grands parcs à Beyrouth, la place des Martyrs, ou d'autres parcs, on a en fait beaucoup de monde, pas nécessairement des tentes, mais des matelas, des gens sur des matelas. Il y a effectivement une présence humanitaire, que ce soit les UN, les personnes des Nations Unies, l'OIM, etc., ou des membres de la communauté, ou bien qui sont effectivement là-bas pour pouvoir leur donner un soutien, un appui immédiat, mais aussi pouvoir les orienter vers des abris qui existent. Le problème, c'est que les abris à Beyrouth et la province du Mont Liban sont tous pleins. Donc, il y a en fait des abris qui sont collectifs, qui sont disponibles, des écoles qui ne sont pas complètes, mais c'est beaucoup plus loin, dans le nord, à Akkar, par exemple. Donc, il faut s'organiser, et c'est ce que le gouvernement est en train de faire aussi avec l'appui de l'armée, pour pouvoir transporter les personnes de Beyrouth et du Mont Liban en particulier vers les abris qui sont disponibles dans le nord.
Merci beaucoup. The second question for Rula.
Yes, thanks. So, you know, before this conflict started, Syrian refugees in Lebanon and elsewhere in the region were telling us that they still had many concerns, or what we call obstacles, that is preventing them from taking the decision to return. And this did include safety and security, lack of livelihood, lack of housing, lack of basic services and access to these services. What we're saying today is that with the risks these people, with the refugees, are facing in Lebanon due to the bombings, lack of adequate shelters, lack of access to services, is making refugees make a very, very difficult choice. So it's either staying in Lebanon with that growing risk on their lives, or taking the decision to go back and cross the border to Syria, with all the other risks in mind. But it seems from the numbers of people we have been seeing is that at this point, they felt that the risks from the bombings is higher. So I think it's a very good reminder of all the hardship and the suffering that Syrian refugees had faced throughout the past 13 years. Now they are reliving that experience, they're traumatized, they have to be displaced again, they left all their belongings and their homes again, and they are making very difficult choices. Now, as UNHCR, we are trying to follow up with them in the destinations where they go. Any reports we get, we try to follow up with the authorities. And we have been working in the past few years with the different stakeholders, including Syrian authorities, including international donors, to address what the obstacles and the challenges that the refugees are facing. Today, we are very focused on trying to give assistance and support and relief to those who are crossing, fleeing the airstrikes, and who many of them have no immediate plans. All they want to feel is protected from the bombings. So we're following up with them. Much humanitarian assistance is needed, as well as addressing the other concerns, including the ones you mentioned.
Thank you so much, Rula. Okay, well, I know we have a couple more questions in the room, but let's go online first because Emma has been waiting. Emma of Reuters, and if you can direct your question to the person.
Thank you. Yeah, I had a couple of questions for the panelists, and then I had a broader question for anyone, or maybe Jens might want to jump in. I can see him in the room if available. But so the broader question is, how many UN workers have been killed in Lebanon since the escalation in fighting? And are you concerned that they're actually being aimed at? And is this following the Gaza playbook? And what can the UN do about it? That's the general one. And then the sort of more targeted ones. For UNHCR, please. You mentioned that most of the 900 government shelters were full in Lebanon. Are there other non-government shelters available? Or can you build more shelters? Is this happening? And also, with the Syria road being cut off, are there any other routes for people to flee, or are they kind of trying to find other routes? What are they doing? And finally, I would like to invite IOM to say a little bit more about the migrant workers who are trapped and where they're from. Thank you very much.
Maybe Rula, perhaps we can start with you on that question pointed to you.
So I can start in regard to the Masnaa border crossing. There were two strikes and a huge crater was created in the no man's land between the Syrian and the Lebanese side. So vehicles, I think it's very hard for vehicles still to go through this road. However, just before this briefing started, our representative was on the ground and we could see that some people were taking, walking, desperate to flee Lebanon. And so they walked actually through that destroyed road and trying to cross into Syria, and they did cross. We have to also remember there are another three border crossings that are still open and still operational. But of course, the Masnaa, as you know, is the main entry point that people have been using. Now, you also asked about, what was your second question?
The thing, it was a broader question, but maybe if there was something.
It was also about the shelters. Are you building ones, non-government shelters? And
sure.
Thank you.
So the established shelters seem to be at full capacity. And there are, of course, all the other issues. We are working with other humanitarian partners and the government to try to find alternative solutions. Lebanese civil society, local initiatives, have also started, you know, some hotels had opened their doors. We even saw some clubs opening their doors to host people, but this is not enough, especially for the refugees who don't have this. As you know, there are no refugee camps for Syrian refugees and except for Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, there are the informal settlements. We're trying to find ways to find a makeshift shelters and in different, working with the municipalities and other local governments to find such solutions, but no plans to establish refugee camps, if that is something that I can assure you.
Thanks, Rula. Maybe on the broader question, just to say, we don't have those specific numbers of those killed. Of course, it's of paramount importance. The protection of civilians, as you've heard from all our speakers here, is obviously the priority. Our peacekeepers in the south of Lebanon, from UNIFIL, remain in position and doing what they can to deliver their very lofty mandate under these very dire circumstances. But providing you with these specific figures, we cannot at the moment, but maybe we can double back to you as this situation is fluid and as some numbers do become available, but of course, paramount importance is the protection of civilians and our own staff, naturally. Christian of German News Agency.
Thank you. I'm a bit drowning in the numbers. I wonder whether Mathieu and Rula can confirm the number of people who have crossed into Syria. I heard 180 and then I heard 235,000, 180,000 and 235,000. Can you specify? And I very much wanted to ask the same question as Emma about the domestic workers. Maybe you can shed a bit more light on the numbers, on the countries they come from, and maybe situations that you have actually seen, desperate situations of people that you've seen. Maybe you can flesh this out a little bit for us. Thank you.
Yeah, indeed. The numbers are always, it's such a fluid situation, of course, Christiane. And colleagues, if you could share the numbers in writing with qualifications, that would be of enormous help. But in terms of, so maybe Rula, you can expand on the numbers you shared, and maybe our colleague from IOM, if you're still there, Matthew. So, over to you, Rula.
So we do have, you know, different figures because we're relying on different sources. So our figures are the minimum, and we are getting these figures from the Syrian Red Crescent. I think IOM, as the colleague mentioned, these are the Lebanese government figures. And we have to remember also that people are crossing through the official border crossings, but also they are crossing through other ways. And this figure has not been captured. It's only assessed. I leave it to IOM if they would like to add anything.
Thank you, Rula. Matthew?
Thank you very much. No, on the discrepancy between the figures, I think, yes, the source is the reason why. As I said, our figures on the border crossings come from the Lebanese authorities and not, you know, not from the Syrian side. So the latest we received yesterday evening was indeed 235,000 people who had crossed. Let me just double check again. But that's what I said. We do have the breakdown actually of regular and irregular crossing, which I'm happy to share. I don't have it here with me, but I'm happy to share later on. If I may, then just to go back on the Emma's question, but also the Christiane question on migrant workers. But before, just I wanted to go back to Emma's question on the shelter. So now you have 800 shelter, government-led shelters in the country. And 75% are full. There's a live dashboard, so that's the information from an hour ago when the briefing started, but that's updated on a regular basis. So they're not all at full capacity, but most of them are. And for sure, as I said, I mean, all of the shelters in Beirut and Mount Lebanon are full. In terms of, and as UNHCR said, one of the priorities is to work with the government to identify new sites which could be used as shelters. So the effort from the government to identify, from all ministries, to identify which facilities they own, which could be used as a shelter. For now, it's mostly the Ministry of Education, which provided their facilities. That's why, you know, most of the shelters are schools, but that's not great because that disrupts as well education, and schools should be used as the last resort for collective shelters. So since yesterday, the day before, the Ministry of Agriculture has proposed as well some sites of technical and vocational training schools, and other ministries are also following suit to make sure that we can potentially accommodate a larger number of displaced, but also relocate people from the existing schools to others. So a lot of work ongoing, and UNHCR is leading on this, is to assess those potential sites, see what repairs are needed, and cooperate with colleagues, UNICEF and WASH Center as well, to see what upgrade and installation have to be made so that these sites can be used. So this is indeed a priority as well, as I said, identifying new sites and preparing new sites for displacement. In addition to those 800 shelters, you also have spontaneous shelters, where, you know, which is not school, but I mean other places, private facilities, hotels, private schools, where IDPs went. So there's an effort currently, and IOM is working on that with the government to track those as well, to make sure that they feed into these dashboards, master lists, so that we all humanitarian know actually where people are and are able to assess their need and respond to their needs. On migrant workers, the country, you know, relies, I mean, Lebanon relies heavily on migrant workers, especially for domestic work. So you have 170,000 migrant workers. Again, there's a report that IOM publishes every year, which shows, you know, numbers, demographics, and nationalities, which I'm happy to share. They come mostly from Egypt, Sudan, Ethiopia, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka, I think are the top five nationalities. And they're mostly women, because they're mostly women working as domestic workers or elderly care. As you can imagine, and that didn't start, you know, a year ago, but migrant workers are partly vulnerable And they've been affected by all different crises that, you know, Lebanon faced, whether it's the Beirut blast or then the economic crisis in 2019, and then the war since, a year ago, and the escalation in violence in the past 2 weeks. What we've seen is, significant protection risks. Most of them are, you know, live-in domestic workers, which means that they live with their employers. They don't have their own place. So we've seen in the South, you know, that the employers would leave, but then would either actually leave the domestic worker on the streets, wouldn't relocate with them, or actually even worse, you know, lock the domestic worker in to make sure that, you know, the house is actually kept where they're seeking safety somewhere else. We have huge issues around mental health, you know, among domestic workers, and those left on the street, they also cannot relocate. They cannot, you know, access transportation to go to seek safety. So it's also very complicated for them to access humanitarian assistance. Many are undocumented. They don't have papers. They hit irregularly, and as a result, they're pretty reluctant to seek humanitarian assistance because they fear that they may be arrested and they may be deported. They also don't speak the language. So our role as IOM, as the migration agency, is really to ensure and work with all our colleagues, I mean HER and all the humanitarian partners and the government, to ensure that they're included, migrants are included and taken into account in preparedness efforts and response efforts. And we coordinate within the protection sector a working group where all the different NGOs, agencies who provide assistance to migrants can share and discuss and be supported. There's again more information available on our website. For us, again, it's a smaller population. It's smaller than the Lebanese, than the refugees, than the Palestinian refugees in terms of numbers. But what we see on the ground is that they have been affected, and they have barriers when it comes to accessing humanitarian assistance.
Thank you very much, Mathieu, and Kennedy's in the room, as well as Matt online for both IOM and HCR for any further clarifications on that. Thank you. We'll take the last two questions from the room, and then we'll move on to the next subject. So Moussa and then John. Moussa.
Merci. Ma question pour Mathieu. Est-ce que vous avez parlé tout à l'heure de nombre de personnel de santé tué au Liban. Un centre a été visé vers Bachoura. C'est une place qui est près de la place de Martyrs, à 200 mètres de la place de Martyrs à Beyrouth. On dit à Beyrouth que cette place était une place de santé, un centre de santé, des ambulanciers. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous confirmer la nature de ce centre et combien de morts, si ce sont des morts de personnel de santé qui ont donc dans ce centre? Another question for Rola, maybe. The situation on the border between Syria and Lebanon, how the level of danger for in this border, because I know Masna border was not the first crossing targeted by Israel. Thank you.
Thank you, Mathieu.
Oui, merci. Donc Bachoura, effectivement, c'est au centre de Beyrouth. C'est pas très loin de la place des Martyrs, c'est pas très loin des différents sièges des Nations Unies, c'est pas très loin de chez moi non plus. Et c'est effectivement un centre de santé. Je vérifie maintenant, c'est les derniers chiffres en matière de blessés. Donc en fait, c'est un centre de santé qui était géré et affilié au Hezbollah. Donc c'est pas un centre de santé affilié au gouvernement, mais au Hezbollah. Et ce que je vois, mais alors faudra confirmer, c'est effectivement 9 personnes tuées et 14 blessées. Et ça, c'est vraiment ce que je lis là dans la presse aussi pour vérifier. Voilà.
OK, thank you very much. Rula.
OK, so as far as I know, today's strike was the one that was closest to an actual border. As far as we know, and from colleagues who are on the ground, the other three border crossings are still operational and people are still using them. Even Masna today, as I said before, some people are walking, desperate to leave and cross. So they are walking on the destroyed road and then getting to the Syrian side. But of course, the numbers are not as huge as we have seen in the past few days. I think it's a testimony to the fear and panic that is driving people to just cross into Syria.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Rula, for that. John Zarkosis, maybe last question on this subject.
Yeah.
John.
My question is to the IOM rep. If you could please clarify your figures on 400,000 plus IDPs. They're at variance with the numbers given by the UN in the launch of their appeal of over a million displaced, and the government says 1.2 million displaced. So can you elaborate how you do your figures in your matrix? Is that an algorithm, or is that actually verified IDPs on the ground? What's the differential? And secondly, to the UNHCR rep in Amman, the people entering Syria, is there any processing fee levied by the Syrian authorities, or are they entering free of cost? Thank you.
Thank you, John. Matthew? Matthew, are you still with us? Okay, I don't see him connecting, so maybe we'll just go to you, Rula, on the question about the processing fee. I believe I understood that correctly. Rula.
The processing fee, the $100, the government has waived that fee for about 1 week, and we are advocating with the government to extend that waiver so that people won't have or won't face any challenges to go in. Before this fee was waived, we're talking about the Syrian side now. I think this was the question. Even people who didn't have the means to pay it, we saw other people crossing who had more resources actually chipped in and helped them. Some of them were exempted, but now it's official that they don't need to pay it. But we are advocating for this waiver to be extended, unless you're talking about a different thing.
Is that right, John? That's what you're looking for, yeah?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, great. Thank you very much, Rula. On this note, I'd like to thank all our briefers, Rula, Matthew, who I understand had to leave. So I think the first question, maybe if you can liaise with Kennedy, who's in the room here. And Christian, of course, merci, bienvenue. And we will share your contacts with our colleagues here. Thank you very much for joining us. So we now turn to the last item on the agenda, Monica Totova, senior economist of the Food and Agricultural Organization, who you know well, who is here to provide us with a monthly update on global food commodity prices, is joining us from Rome. Monica, over to you.
Thank you. At this point, I guess I can wish you good afternoon. It's midday in Rome. So after the distressing topics we listened to this morning, a briefing about global food commodity prices might sound little ordinary, but I did want to bring to your attention that the FAO Food Price Index, which we released this morning, increased by 3% in September compared to its August level. And this increase of 3% marks the largest month-on-month increase in the past 18 months, that is since March 2022. Price quotations for all commodities that are included in the index, that is cereals, vegetable oils, meat, dairy, and sugar, increased in different levels from about 0.5% for meat price and over 10% for sugar. Compared to the historical levels in September, the index was about 2% higher than its corresponding value a year ago, but still about 22% below the peak reached in March 2022, I mentioned earlier. Of course, there are many factors that impact price transmission from the global reference prices to domestic prices and then along the food chain, and it's true, up for the prices change all the time, so we shouldn't be deriving any longer-term conclusions. It is to be seen how the situation develops. We are monitoring it. And responsible for increases this particular month were both weather and policy and related issue. In the interest of time, considering that we are running quite late, I will not go to the details of the specific commodities, but the briefing was shared with you earlier. I will end it here. If there are any questions, I'll be happy to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Monica. And of course, Key is connected and can share this note with you. Do we have questions for Monica? No, I don't see that's the case, Monica. So thank you once again for this update. All the best. Thank you. Okay, colleagues, just a couple of notes as usual for me, just to keep you on track. We have the Committee on Enforced Disappearances, which will conclude its 27th session this afternoon after issuing its concluding observations for Ukraine, Morocco, and Norway. And this coming Monday, the 7th of October, the Committee on the Elimination of Discriminations Against Women, otherwise known as CEDAW, will commence its 89th session. A number of countries to be reviewed, including Laos, Saudi Arabia, New Zealand, Chile, Canada, Japan, Cuba, and Benin. So that is a three-week session starting on Monday. And lastly, as I mentioned to you already on Tuesday, the press conference from the World Meteorological Organization is still scheduled to take place this coming Monday, the 7th of October, at 10 a.m. Celeste Saulo, the WMO Secretary General, will be sitting here to brief you on the state of the Global Water Resources Report, so 10 a.m. Monday. And lastly, just to mention that today, or no, not today, today is the 4th, so Monday, the 7th of October, once again, it's World Habitat Day. There's a Secretary General message on this observance. World Habitat Day is an opportunity to reaffirm the basic right to shelter and reflect on the transformation of urban environments. We talked a lot about shelter during this briefing in the context of Lebanon and, of course, in Gaza. This year's theme highlights the vital role of young people in creating a better urban future. And by 2030, 60% of urban residents will be under the age of 18, the message of the SG notes. So that message was shared with you. That's all I have. Do you have questions for me? No, that's not the case. So on that note, I wish you bon appetit, bon weekend. See you here on Tuesday.